Today is March the 3rd, and we're in Yechezkel. We are in Perek Mem Gimel, which is chapter 43, and we are up to, what did we say, Pasuk?
10.
Yud. Okay, verse 10. Okay. And as we said, this is the Haftorah that is normally lands on Parshas Tetzaveh when it's not one of the four special Parshas, like this past week, or as Parshas Zachar, we didn't read it, but it is officially the Haftorah for Parshas Zachar. Atah ben Adam Hagedes Beis Yisrael Es HaBayis, and you, son of man, speak to the house of Israel about the bias, of course, the Beis HaMikdash, the Kalmu Me'avonoseihem, and they will be ashamed from their sins. Rashi explains this means that they'll be ashamed about the fact that I am willing to deal with them and build the Beis HaMikdash for them, even though they sinned. So they'll be ashamed that they sinned. Umadadu es tachnis, and they should measure all of the all the calculations that are involved in the building. And if they have been ashamed from all they've done, then here's the various things that they're going to know about. Tsuras habayis, the form of the house. Uschuna so, and its calculations. Umotza of, and it's literally this means its comings out. Umova of, and its goings in. And all of its forms, the eighth kol chukosav, and all of its statutes, v'chol tzurosav, again another word for forms, v'chol torosav, and all its laws, hoda osam, you should make known to them, uchsov la'enehem, and write it in front of their eyes. So this is referring to all of the various details of the Beis HaMikdash, the third Beis HaMikdash, that we've already mentioned until now, and the ones that will be mentioned coming up. V'yishmeru es kol tzurosav, es kol chukosav, v'osu osam, and they should guard all of its forms and all of its laws, and do them. So Rashi tells us over here that this is where he says it, although we mentioned it way back when we started talking about the third Beis HaMikdash, that I'll read to you the Rashi actually. Ru'uya haisa bia shnia shal Ezra, it was fitting that the second time that the Jews entered Eretz Yisrael, the time of Ezra, it was fitting that it should have been like the first time they entered Eretz Yisrael under Yehoshua. Lavo bizroa ubenes, that they should come bizroa, which means with an outstretched arm, ubenes, and with miracles, the same way as with Yehoshua. As the, and he brings a pasuk about this from Az Yashir, kiddashinan adya avar, like we learned the pasuk of adya avar. Ubinyan zeh, and this building, this third Beis HaMikdash that is being described by Yechezkel, me'az hayaroy lahem, it was really fit for them from back then. Ezra should have built the third Beis HaMikdash, what would have been the form of the third Beis HaMikdash, kesha'olu min ha'gola, when they came up from the Golas, the Geulas Olam, for a redemption forever. The second Beis HaMikdash should have been the final Beis HaMikdash, and never have been destroyed. Ela shagaram hachet, but the sin caused shelo haisa tshuvasam hogenes, that their tshuva was not complete, was not total, amanash shelo lachto, on condition to never sin again. Even though they did do tshuva at the time of Esther, and therefore they did go back to the Eretz Yisrael, and they did rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, but it was not a complete tshuva to the point where they would never sin again. V'yatzu b'rishus koresh, and they went up with the permission of Koresh, Ubanu La'atzman, and they built the Beis HaMikdash for themselves, but it was not the same thing as this third Beis HaMikdash. So this third Beis HaMikdash is for those who have completely repented, which is what's going to happen, Mirz Hashem, when the third Beis HaMikdash is built. Yeah?
You're saying that we will never sin again?
We will never sin in the same way. I don't know if it means never to do any sins, but it means it'll never be a national type of thing where there's so much sin going on. Yeah.
I was wondering also, after the Megillah, it occurred to me that Mordechai was exiled in the time of Yechonah. So the time of Esther, he must have been pretty
old. Yeah.
I mean, never occurred to me before this.
Yeah, for sure. He must have been very old. He must have been Achashverosh. Comes to power, I believe it's 17 years before the building of the before the end of the Golas. I think it's around 17 or something like that. And Mordechai went into Galus 11 years before the Galus started. So we're talking 64 years since he went into Galus is when, well, no, that's not true. Yeah, right, is when Ahasuerus comes to power, something like that. So, he must have been old. Yeah, I don't know how old, but I mean, he was already considered to be a chashuv person when he went into Galus, although he may have been young. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are young when they go into Galus, even though they're considered to be chashuv people. Zos Taras HaBayis, this is the law of the Bayis. Arosh Shahar, on top of the mountain. Kol Zvulo, Saviv, Saviv, Kodesh Kadashim, all its boundaries around it are Holy of Holies, meaning, doesn't mean Kodesh Kadashim, of course, like the inner sanctuary, but it means compared to what's around it. Hine Zos Taras HaBayis, this is the law of the Bayis. Referring again to all the measurements that we've had until now. And now we move to the Mizbeach, and this is what we gave introduction to last time. Ve'ela midos ha-Mizbeach, these are the measurements of the Mizbeach, va'amos, using amos, cubits, ama, ama, va'tofach, a cubit, and a tefach, a hand breath. So, we explained last time that there's two different measurements of amos. There's the 5 tefach ama, and there's the 6 tefach ama. And here what the Pasuk is saying is that the Mizbeach is measured ba'amos, with two different types of amos. With the Mizbeach, sometimes you use the regular 6 tefach ama, and sometimes you use the 5 tefach ama. Ama, one of them is an ama, which is a 5 tefach ama. Ama va'tofach. And sometimes you use the ama plus a tefach, which would be a 6 tefach ama. So depending on the part of the Mizbeach that you're measuring, sometimes you use the 6 tefach ama, sometimes you use the 5 tefach ama.
And why?
I don't know why that is. I don't know why it is. And now the Pasuk tells us which parts of the Mizbeach get the 5 tefach ama. The chek ama, the chek, which is the yesod, that's the base, that gets a 5 tefach ama. The ama rochav, and the ama of width, which is the sovev, which is the part the kohanim go around on. Ugvula el sfasa saviv, and its boundary to its lip around. This refers to the corners on the top of the mizbeach. Zeres ha'echad, 1 half hand breath. Vezegav ha'mizbeach, this is the top of the mizbeach. Those last 3 words refers to the golden mizbeach, also has 5 tefach amos. So this pasuk is a very hard pasuk to read, as you can tell in the translation. It's very, very difficult. The Gemara struggles mightily in explaining this pasuk, and then after the Gemara, Rashi then has a whole explanation for the Gemara. Then Rashi writes, but after I wrote all of this, I realized that it's not correct, and he has another explanation which he gives. So this pasuk is a very hard pasuk to translate. But what the consensus is in the end, and we talked about this last time, but let's show it on the board, is that, as we showed last time, again, using we don't really need the pen, but looking at the Mizbeach, facing the Mizbeach, we showed that this is the Yesod, the bottom block, which is 32 amos by 32 amos, it's a square, 32 amos by 32 amos, and it's 2 amos high. Then it goes in 1 amma. Then you have the next large piece, which is 4 amos high, and it's 30 amos by 30 amos. Then you go in another amma. And then you have another piece, which is a machlokas, whether it's 3 or 4 amos high. And it is 28 amos by 28 amos, till you get to the very top, where you have corner pieces, which are each an amma by an amma. So we pointed out last time that some of these amos are measured with 6 tefachim, some are measured with 5 tefachim. So as we mentioned last time, the parts that are circled are the ones that are 5 tefach amos. So what the pasuk is saying over here is chek ha'ama. Chek means the yesod, which means the foundation. The foundation, although it was 2 amos high, it measures with the 5 tefach amos. then it goes one tefach, one amma in, that's a regular six tefach amma.
Mm-hmm.
Four ammos up, that's a regular six tefach amma. One amma in, that's the sovev, that's where the kohanim walk around the mizbeach, that is a five tefach amma. Three or four ammos next, higher, that's a regular six tefach amma. And then the corner piece is an amma by an amma, which is using the five tefach amma. That's how it works. And we showed last time that there are two places, let's get our bearings over here, there are two places where the Kohanim would walk around the Mizbeach, depending on what they were doing. Either they walked around on the very top of the Mizbeach, or they walked around on this ledge here, on this Sovev, the part that goes around. They would not walk around on the base here. The base here had a ridge in it, had a, what's a good word? It had a
trench.
It had a trench going around, and that trench is when they pour the blood on the mizbeach, when they threw it on the sides of the mizbeach, the blood would roll into the trench and then roll to a particular place where it would drain off. So this that was in this on this ledge here of where the yesod is, where the foundation is.
The rabbi, where the Kohen Gadol would walk, and the Kohen would walk around, one almost means around 2.5 feet.
It's only a five tefach amma, so we're talking between 15 and 20 inches, depending on how you measure a tefach.
They
had to walk around.
Why did they walk around there?
Sometimes they had to walk around here, depending on what they had to do. If they had to burn something on the Mizbeach, they would go on top of the Mizbeach. If they had to put blood on the corners, which sometimes had to happen, then they would walk around
but the other part is 6 foot tall. How do they...
Yeah.
What's that?
If they're on that ledge, right? Not the Yisod ledge, but the next one up, right? And they're there...
And you have to reach up here?
Yeah. Well, right there, it's 6 feet.
Well, it's between 4.5 and 6 feet.
So
they have very tall corners.
You have to jump
to get up to that corner. You're really
you can jump 4 feet.
Jump down.
No, you can't jump on a little ledge like that.
Jump on a ledge.
Pretty dangerous. Yeah.
Ready?
Yeah.
Give me another rope.
I'm not
Okay, no, that's a good question.
It could
be you're right. It could be that if they had to put blood on the actual corners, they would go on top. The other thing that would have to be done over here is that certain types of offerings. See, we haven't gone through karbanos. When we talk about karbanos, most of the time we're talking about animals. So when they shechted an animal, the blood would be caught in a pail, in a bowl, and then the blood would be taken to the mizbeach. And most of the time, the blood was thrown onto the mizbeach. The coin would stand on the floor, not up top. It would stand on the floor and throw the mizbeach below this ledge. Those would be the lower bloods. The blood would be thrown into the corners, at the corners, below this ledge. That was typically what happened. Usually, it's a four-sided mizbeach. Here's a four-sided mizbeach. They would throw it at two of the corners. The Mishnah says, Shayim Shehein Arba, two which are four. They would throw it at this corner and at this corner. The blood would then go to either side, and that way all sides would get hit, but only with two throwings of blood.
Mm-hmm.
That would be done by the Kohen standing on the floor and throwing the blood. There were, whenever a bird was offered, which was not as common as an animal, but the bird, the blood rather than being caught in a bowl, a bird has less blood, and it's not caught in a bowl. Instead, after the animal was shechted, after it was slaughtered, the Kohen would actually take the bird over to the Mizbeach and push it against the mizbeach, so that the blood would come out onto the corner of the mizbeach. That would be the way to get the blood out. So sometimes a bird, the blood of the bird, had to be on the upper level of the mizbeach, and so he would walk around the mizbeach and put the blood where it's supposed to go. So then it wouldn't have to go on the top; it would just be on this area here, on this upper area, pushed up against the mizbeach.
So that would be the check of an animal. Are we talking about a cup of blood? I mean, a pint of blood. How much blood are we talking about here? And it was sprinkled. It wasn't.
It wasn't sprinkled. It was thrown. I know we say sprinkled. That's wrong. It was thrown. The language is Zorik. No. It wasn't. It was done with the.
The bowl.
It was
splash.
Splash. That's a good word. Splash.
How much was in that bowl?
I don't know. Yeah. Enough to throw it twice. Now the reason why you're thinking about using your fingers and all that, because on Yom Kippur, that's what was done in the Kodesh HaKadoshim with his fingers.
Uh-huh.
Right, that's a different process. And there are some, the Achatas has that as well, and that's when it goes on the corners on the very top. And that's a different, it's different, different karbanos have different requirements for what to do with the blood. But that's the typical thing. So different, depending on the type of karban, either was done from the floor, done from the ledge, done from the top, depending on what's going on.
But they had the ramp, didn't they? To achieve the top to close.
Yeah, the ramp would only go on one side. It was only on the south side. It would take you to the top or to the ledge, and then you had to walk around.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you said last week that they did their own laundry, where are they doing this laundry?
Well, I don't know if they did their own. I didn't say they. The clothes had to be laundered.
The clothes had to be laundered. I mean, they're bloody.
Yeah.
Can they leave the Temple Mount?
I think that they were washed there. I think they washed it. I believe so.
Which of the were any of the rooms?
Yeah. There was a person in charge of clothing. One of the Kohanim was. It was a cabinet post in amongst the Kohanim.
I want to know the soap type. Yeah, what kind of water? Take away the blood. I want to know
very cold water.
What kind was it?
I'm so very
happy. I'm going to start a product.
Now we made this other picture here for the bird's eye view because we wanted to show last time. That if you're looking down from the top of the Mizbeach, you would see this outer ledge, which is the ledge of the foundation that had the little, what was the word you used?
Trench
in it that would catch the blood. Yeah. Then you would see this second ledge, which is the one up here. That's the selvave that the Kohanim could walk around on. Then, looking from the very top, you would see on the very top a square 28 amos by 28 amos that's looking down at this part here, but that was divided up itself into three parts. You had an outer ring, which is where the corners were. They did not walk around over there, that's too close to the edge. You had an inner ring, one amma wide, that they would walk around in. And then you have the very inner area, which is 24 amos by 24 amos, which is where the fires were burning. And that's where the limbs and the fat that had to be burned would be burned on these, and it wasn't only one fire, there were several fires on the Mizbech, a very large one and a few smaller ones. It is a machlokas how many there were. Yeah?
The Karban Mincha, the flour and the wine, would they also pour those on top?
So the wine was poured on top. There was an area on the, I believe the what side was it on? I believe the southwest side, I believe, where there were two, what they call nostrils, two holes. One was for wine and one was for water. Water was only done on Sukkot. Wine was all year round. And that's where the water was poured. The flour, part of it was eaten and part of it was burned. Right. The kmitza, the handful, was burned. Right.
So how do you picture this? It rains only certain seasons in Israel. The blood was just dried up and it was just there. Was it a miracle? Like there was no fly, so there was no blood.
One of the miracles was the fire never went out, even when it rained.
Remember
this was open.
But the rain didn't cover it often, so all that blood is all over the floor.
Oh, they washed it every so often. They did sponge it. That's what we talked about. They did sponge it. There was a stream running through the Beis HaMikdash. They would stop it up. The water would overflow, get all over the. It was marble. It's marble floor. No carpeting.
Dried off.
Yeah. And then they would
clean
it.
They were not barefoot, though.
They were barefoot. No, they were barefoot. They had to be barefoot. They had to be barefoot.
Because you can't wear shoes on.
Yeah, they had to be barefoot.
Messy job.
Huh?
Messy job.
Yeah, no, being a Kohen was a messy job. Yeah. It was a messy job. Yeah. There was no question about it.
Why,
you know, it seems to me like if you were going to build this structure to work with animals and, you know, check to them and clean them, it seems such an awkward place to work.
Why?
Because it's like it's, you know, I'm a woman. I want a kitchen with lots of space. You would think the Beis HaMikdash would have.
Oh, there was lots of space.
But But this, you're walking on little ramps, and you got to...
No. The only part that was little is that sovef, is that that little ledge there. Everything else wasn't little.
It just seems awkward to walk in a place like that. Is it awkward, or was it...
I don't think so.
Huh.
So, like, if you've got a baby in a place, and the baby has a full diaper, you're not supposed to pray, right? Like, if the odor is there. You've got all these animals... who, when they're being shocked, are probably releasing their bodily goods.
Right.
They were washed. One of the things that had to be done with every animal that was shechted was that the digestive tract had to be washed out. Now, that's one of the things. It was a base.
There was no bowel movements going on.
It had to be cleaned. It was washed. There was a designated area. The Beis HaMikdash had a place for the shechita. Right, it was a designated area where you slaughtered the animal, then a designated area where the animal was first, it had to be skinned, and then cut up into the correct parts, and then the intestines had to be washed. Sometimes the intestines were removed completely and just discarded, depending on the type of animal, and sometimes they were washed and then burned.
But isn't it all part of the same open space that they were, so to speak?
But it's a very large area.
So they're very specific
designated areas of what to do. The other thing is that you should be aware that what you're talking about, which is the rules of when you're not allowed to say davar shebekdusha. You can't daven, you can't learn Torah, you can't make a bracha when you have a soiled diaper there, provided that it smells.
Right.
If it's a soiled diaper but it does not smell, it's permitted. Even though if the diaper weren't covering it, it would smell. But if when it's covered, it doesn't smell, it's permitted. But assuming that it's a strong smell, so then it is prohibited. But the excrement of a human being is considered to be worse than that of animals. So that if you're walking on the sidewalk and a person has walked their dog and has not cleaned up after the dog, it does not necessarily preclude you from making a bracha. Because it's not considered to be as, I don't know what the word would
offensive.
Be, offensive, I guess, right, as that of a human being.
Okay.
So here as well, it's animals, so it's not going to be as bad anyway. If there's a very strong smell, it will be a problem, but, that was cleaned. Yeah.
Going to question about the, why is the Kohen barefoot because of the makam that Hashem Shechina was there? Same when Moshe was told to take off his shoes and he was by the burning bush? Because the makam is Kadosh there.
Yeah, yeah.
Not because of the blood and all that, because... The Shechina is present.
Yeah, that's why they had to walk around barefoot.
Barefoot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, the halacha is that the Kohen has to be directly in contact with the Beis HaMikdash. He has to have his feet on the ground. There's even a shaila if the Kohen is standing on someone else. If the Kohen's feet are on someone else's feet,
mm-hmm.
and he's barefoot, but he's standing on another Kohen's feet, and he does one of the services. He catches the blood or throws. Is it valid?
Yeah.
Or perhaps it's not valid because his feet aren't on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a...
Awesome.
Yeah.
There's an interesting comment in the bulletin. Kohanim had no free will. They had a free will in order to... No. In other words, they were born into that. They have a choice, right?
That's right.
But did anybody know to leave it? Kohanim? I mean, were they excommunicated? Were they something that they said this is not their life that they want to leave?
Well, they could marry the wrong woman.
Yeah, that would be a sin. I mean, they only worked because of the fact that there were so many Kohanim that they were divided up into 24 different shifts, and they each worked a week. So it comes out to a little bit more than twice a year. And then they would also all work during the Yom Tovim, especially Pesach, when it was a real busy time.
So the other times they could be doing their
Their real job. Their real job, right. Their day jobs. Yeah. Yeah. ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהינו מלך העולם שהכל נהיה בדברו.
I guess they just saw it as a privilege.
Yes,
which it was.
It was a privilege. Yeah. It was a privilege. Believe me, after the Beis HaMikdash is built, I'm in Israel. I will be jealous of all the Kohanim. Trust me.
You know, they say you can't serve if you have one eyebrow. Right? Like, can they wax it off? Can they, you know, like if somebody's a lefty, can they train to be ambidextrous? And then are they, you know, like, did they do those kind of things?
I imagine they try their best to be able to do the avoda.
So they would try to...
No, I imagine they would. I imagine they would do whatever they could do.
Hmm. But is that a lot of like waxing the one eyebrow so then you have two or whatever?
I don't know.
Why would they want to do it? It's how we look. I can't do
it. There's a job.
No, but if you perform with one eyebrow, you can't serve.
I mean,
So like...
Someone
going to was a Baal Mum, he can't do the regular avoda. He could do some of the ancillary avodas. Pasuk Gedal, verse 14. Umeichek haaretz, and from the foundation on the ground, ad haazara. Now this is a fascinating pasuk. Ad haazara hatachtona, until the bottom. Was that? Yeah, I know, but Azara means, we'll call it sanctuary. Mm-hmm. To the lower sanctuary.
It just says Azara.
Yeah, Shtayim Amos is two Amos. So you go from the lower ledge to the middle ledge, then it's two Amos high. Ferochav Amo Echas, you go in one Amo, we just described this. Umei Ha'azara HaKetana, and from the smaller Azara, the smaller sanctuary, ad ha'azara ha'gedola, until the larger sanctuary, arba amos, you go up four amos, v'rochav ha'ama, and you go in one ama. Let me read the next pasuk before we explain this. The ha'har'el, and the har'el, arba amos, is four amos, umei ha'ari'el ulemala, and from the ari'el and up, ha'kronos arba, there were four corners. So, fascinatingly, Yechezkel is describing these dimensions that we've seen. The bottom one is called the Chek, which we already said, that's the foundation. Then this area here is being called the Azara HaTachtona, or the Azara HaKetana, the small sanctuary or the lower sanctuary. And then this one here is being called either HaHar'el or Ha'ariel. Har'el is a contraction meaning mountain of God. Mm-hmm. And Ha'ariel means the Ariel. What's Ariel? It's a congregation in Dunwoody, right? The lion of God. Ha'ariel. So Yechezkel is giving names to these pieces of the Mizbeach. And calling this one the lower Azara. And this one is, or the small one, this is the big Azara, or the mountain of Hashem, or the lion of Hashem. Okay. And we'll get back to that in a moment. Then, Pasuk Tez Zayin, verse 16, V'ha Ariel, and the Ariel, which is now we're on this top one, Shtem Esrei Orech B'Shtem Esrei Rochav, was 12 by 12, Ravua square, El Abbas Ravav, to its four sides. The Gemara explains this means measuring from the midpoint. Measuring from the midpoint, you can go 12 in each direction, which means it's really 24 by 24. That's what the Gemara explains. And it's not referring to the entire block, because the entire block is actually 28 by 28, but it's referring to the area of the fires. The Ariel, the lion of Hashem, is not referring to the entire block. It's only referring to the part that had the fires on it, which was 24 by 24. So now we see that the term Har'el, mountain of God, refers to the entire block, while Ariel, lion of God, refers to the middle 24 by 24 amos, which had the fires. This is very important to understanding how it's being explained to us. The Ha'azara and the sanctuary, meaning the entire block, top block, Arba Esrei Orech Barba Esrei Rochav, was 14 long by 14 wide, El Arba'as Revo'el, to its four sides, which means 14 by 14 measuring from the midpoint. From the midpoint, you get 14 by 14, which is really 28 by 28, which is the entire block. V'hagevul Saviv Osa, and the boundary around it, referring now to the corners only, Chatzi Ha'ama, was half an Ama. Now, half an Ama meaning measuring from the middle of the corner, it was half an Amma in each direction, which means it was really an Amma by an Amma. It's a funny way of measuring, but that's the way the Pasuk is saying it. V'hachek la Amma saviv, and the chek, which means the yesod itself, the foundation, the area of the foundation that came in, the ledge, was an Amma all around. U'ma'alosehu, and its the way you come up to it, which really means the ramp, Penos Kadim, turns to the east. Okay, so what does that mean? Let's explain the ramp part, and then we'll come back to the other parts that we just mentioned. The ramp turns to the east. Now, that does not mean the ramp is on the east side. It means the ramp turns to the east. So what does that mean? So what that means is that in the Beis HaMikdash, the rule was you always turned to the right. You always turned to the right. So if ever something you had to go anywhere, you always went to the right. If you had to go over there, you would go all the way around and come around that way. You always go to the right. The same way that when we take the Torah out of the Aron today, so what happens? The Chazan takes the Torah, and then he doesn't go to his left. He always goes to his right and comes around to the Bima.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, if when the Chazan is taking the Torah back, he goes to his right and goes up to the Aron.
Yeah.
Because there's a rule called Pinos Shata Pona, any turns that you turn, Lo Yu Ela Yamin, should always be to the right. Because in Kabbalah, the right is always considered to be the more important one than the left. It has nothing to do with whether you personally are a righty or a lefty. It has to do with the overall, whatever esoteric things are going on, the right is considered to be the stronger of the two. And the reason why, because the right represents chesed, it represents kindness, and the left represents din, represents judgment. And we always want the chesed to overpower the din, the judgment. The Gemara says, La'olam yehe smol docha, your left hand should always be pushing away, v'yamin mekarev, and your right should be bringing close. It's referring to discipline. When a rabbi has to discipline a student, or a parent has to discipline a child, so anytime you have to discipline, and unfortunately you have to discipline sometimes with force or with a negative type of discipline, then it should always be the left that's doing the pushing away, and simultaneously the right is bringing close. It's never pushing away, God forbid, two hands, and it's never the right hand pushing away, because that's the strong hand. You always push away with the left hand, which is considered to be, in the general sense, the weaker side. The weaker side does the distancing, while the stronger side does the pulling close. So it's never a case of the person being pushed away. It's always it's a message. The left hand pushing away is a message that you did something wrong, but the right hand is simultaneously sending the message that I love you anyway. And that's the constant push. And that's the message of the small, the left, is din, is judgment, because Hashem uses his left, so to speak. Of course, he doesn't have a left or a right. But kiviyachol, if it were possible, if it were so, based on our understanding, he uses the left to push away whenever he has to punish, but the right is still simultaneously bringing close. So therefore, in the Beis HaMikdash, they always turn to the right. So, it says that the ramp was you turn to the east. That's how we know the ramp was on the south, because if you want if you are coming from the southern direction, ascending the ramp, and you turn to the right, you will now be facing east.
Mm-hmm.
So if the ramp is situated in a way that when you turn you'll be facing east, the ramp has to be on the south. That's what it means over here, that Uma'alo Seyu, and as you're going up, Penos Kanim, you turn to the east. Because the ramp is on the south side.
Is the ramp straight up, or does the ramp...
It's a straight ramp.
It's a
very wide ramp. It's as wide as the Mizbeach itself. Mm-hmm. So it's 28 amos wide, or perhaps even 30 amos wide, if you...
That's 40 feet.
Yeah, it's a very wide ramp. It's a very wide ramp.
Does it go to both levels?
There is a small ledge to get to the lower level, but it's primarily to the upper level, and it's not so steep that it's hard to walk. I mean, it's a long ramp. I mentioned to you, was it last week, about one coin pushing the other coin off the ramp. I mean, it's a very wide ramp. It's not like the kind of thing where you're walking on a very small ledge. It's not Masada, you know. It's a wide.
Right.
So is that why you put on your right shoe first? Because you're supposed to be doing the hesed.
Yeah. That's why with clothing you're supposed to do the right side first. Also with a shirt you put your right sleeve in first. It's always supposed to be the right first to have the right overpower the left. The only exception is when tying shoes, we tie the left first because of the tefillin that they get tied on the left.
So we take off the shoes left first.
Yeah, when taking off. Right.
I didn't know it was tied to the tefillin.
Yeah, that's the idea over there. So it's an amazing thing that Yechezkel refers to these various blocks of the Mizbeach as sanctuaries, almost as if they are themselves a Beis HaMikdash.
Mm-hmm.
We had in the Beis HaMikdash, you have the outer courtyard, the inner courtyard, the sanctuary, the main sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, various parts, the Azara, the Kodesh, the Kodesh HaKadosh, and various parts, the Heichal, various parts of the Beis HaMikdash with ascending order of Kedusha, of holiness. And here, with the Mizbeach, he also uses these interesting terms, almost as if they themselves are a micro Beis HaMikdash. Even though there's no place to stand inside of, it's not a building, it's a block. And yet, he calls them these things. Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, in Parashas Truma, discusses the Mizbeach, and he touches on this pasuk in Yechezkel. Very, very interesting discussion that he has, talking about these various words, these terms Yechezkel uses to describe the Mizbeach. So he has a very long discussion, and we're not going to discuss it all now. But in reference to the top block, which he calls Har-El and Ariel, so Rav Hirsch says that Har-El, the mountain of Hashem, as I mentioned to you before, refers to the actual top block, while Ariel refers to the lion of Hashem, refers to the fires that are on top of the Mizbeach.
Also the level which the fires are on, or just the fires themselves?
It seems like the level that they're on, but primarily the fires as well. It's the fires give name to the level itself.
Okay.
That's what it seems. Dina, can I trouble you for a chomish, please? I'm sorry. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. I want to read to you from a Rashi in Parshas Bamidbar, just to accentuate this point. In Parshas Bamidbar, at the end of the Parsha, there's a description of how the Levim prepared the Mishkan for travel. They would dismantle the Mishkan. The Mishkan was constantly being taken apart and put back together. They would dismantle the Mishkan. And then what would they do with each of the utensils? The Shulchan, the Menorah, the Mizbeach. What would they do with each of them? So each one had a very special material that was like, it was like a large bag, but it was made out of a certain material, a certain type of wool, and it was covered or wrapped in this material, and that's how it was transported. They didn't just carry the shulchan open; they would cover it with a special material, and then they would carry it through the midbar. So, what about the Mizbeach? The Mizbeach had to be covered as well. The problem is that the Mizbeach had a fire on it, and you're not allowed to put out the fire.
Even when they carry it?
Not allowed to put it out. You're not allowed to extinguish the fire on top of the Mizbeach. It has to burn constantly. You can't put it out. So what happens to that fire on top of the Mizbeach? Now, as I mentioned to you, there were a few different fires, and you're allowed to put out most of them, but there's one specific one which you're not allowed to put out, which was ignited at the very inception of the Mizbeach, from a fire that came down from heaven. Mm-hmm. It came down, burned up the sacrifice, and that fire remains lit. So then they can't put it out. So then how do they transport it underneath this wool material? It'll burn everything up. Mm-hmm. So Rashi says, the pasuk says, let me find it over here. V'dishnu es ha-mizbeach, they remove the ashes from the Mizbeach, ufarsu alav, and they covered it with, they spread over it, beged argamon, a purple dyed wool material. That's what they spread over the Mizbeach. So Rashi says, Ve'esh sheyarda min ha-shamayim, and the fire that had come down from heaven. What happened to that fire? Revutza tachas ha-beged. It was crouching underneath this material. Listen to his language. Ka'ari.
Like a lion.
Bishas hamasos, when they traveled. Ve'ena sarfaso, and it doesn't burn it up. Shayu kofin aleha psachter shal nechoshes, because they would cover it with a bowl, an inverted bowl made out of copper. Now obviously it was a nace, because it didn't extinguish it. Didn't, even though there was no oxygen, it did not extinguish the fire, and also I would imagine that copper would have gotten red hot, which also might have ignited the beged that was on top of it, but that didn't happen. But the language of Rashi, that the fire was crouching underneath like a lion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating choice of words.
Okay,
yeah.
We're talking about large. Okay. Again, how large is this?
No, that was a small fire. That part was small. It was a small fire. The big fire, there was a very large fire on top of the Mizbeach that they were able to extinguish when they traveled. But there was a smaller fire that they weren't allowed to put out.
Really small. Fire?
I don't know how tiny.
You're not talking about like this. You're talking about.
It was covered with a pot, so you know, with a bowl. So I don't know exactly how big it is.
How do you pick this up and move it?
No, not this one.
I know this one didn't. What was the size difference in the Mishkan?
Oh, it was much smaller. The Mishkan was much smaller than this. This is gigantic. Yeah. I mean, this is stone. I mean, this is you know.
But the other one was the ramp attached, or did they detach?
I believe the ramp was detached. The ramp, I believe, was detached. So, but you see the same language, crouching like a lion. Where's Rashi getting that from? I mean, the Gemara really says he's getting it from here. Because here it's being called the lion. Right? The fire is the lion. So what Rav Hirsch says, what he does, is he compares this part of the Mizbeach, the top layer, the top block, and the fire, to Har Sinai.
Mm-hmm.
Har El, the mountain of Hashem, and Ariel, the lion of Hashem. Says Rav Hirsch that this is meant to be analogous of Har Sinai, where the Pasuk tells us, Vahar Sinai, I'm reading from Parshas Yisro now, Vahar Sinai Ashan Kulo, Har Sinai was completely full of smoke, Mipnei Asher Yarad Alav Hashem Ba'esh. For Hashem had come down on Har Sinai with fire. So there was fire on top of the Mizbeach, on top of Har Sinai, and here you have like a miniature Har Sinai.
Mm-hmm.
The Mizbeach is meant to be a small replica of Har Sinai at the time of Matan Torah, where you have Harel, the mountain of Hashem, Ariel, with the fire of Hashem, the lion of Hashem, on top of the mountain. That's what it's supposed to be a replica of. And for those of you who are familiar with Tehillim, which I unfortunately am not so familiar with Tehillim, but there is a pasuk in Tehillim. Let me see if I can find it quickly here. There is a pasuk in Tehillim that says, yeah, it's in Kapitel Samaches in 68, chapter 68 of Tehillim. This chapter is discussing Matan Torah. That's what it's talking about. It's talking about Matan Torah. Many of the psukim in this capital of Tehillim, the Gemara expounds upon them when it tells us the story of what happened in Matan Torah, where Moshe Rabbeinu went up to get the Torah, and the angels wanted to destroy him, and Hashem said, "Hold on to my throne." All those. The stories that Gemara tells us about the time when we got the Torah and how every word that came out of Hashem's mouth that we heard, we all died, all of our neshamas left us, and then the angels came and revived us. All that discussion is based on psukim here in Samaches in 68. So there's a pasuk here that says, Hashem bam, Hashem is in them. Sinai Bakodesh. Sinai in the sanctuary. In the Kodesh, in the holy. So what Rav Hirsch says is this pasuk is a reference to that Hashem figuratively put Har Sinai in the Beis HaMikdash, Ba-Kodesh, in the Beis HaMikdash, in the house of Mikdash, in the Kodesh. Hashem put Sinai into the Beis HaMikdash, so that there is a constant replica of Har Sinai at the time of Matan Torah in the Beis HaMikdash, the Harel and the Ariel, the mountain and the fire burning on top. And that's meant to bring us back to Matan Torah every time we see the Mizbeach. An interesting sidebar about this pasuk, Hashem bam Sinai ba-Kodesh, Hashem is in them, Sinai is in the Kodesh, is there is a dispute of when a Sefer Torah is written, how many lines should each column have of the Sefer Torah? Sefer Torah has long columns. How many lines should be in each column? Some say 42, some say 48, some say 60. Different opinions. The one who says 42 uses this pasuk as a remez, as a hint to their opinion. Because Hashem bam, Hashem is in them, Sinai ba-Kodesh, Sinai is in the Kodesh. The word bum, spelled Beis Mem, 42. Is 42 in Gematria. So he used this pasuk, Hashem bum, Hashem is in them, meaning in the Jews, Sinai Ba-Kodesh, but he wants to say, according to this opinion, that it's also a reference to the Sefer Torah itself, which makes it a very, it's one of the opinions in the it's brought in the in the Nemukhi Yosef and the Gemara. So the according to this opinion, it would then emerge that this pasuk contains in it Matan Torah, the Sefer Torah, and the Mizbeach. In this phrase, Hashem Bam Sinai Ba-Kodesh includes within it a reference to all these things. A very interesting pasuk in that regard.
So how many lines do we have?
I don't know a standard Sefer Torah, how many lines it has. I don't know.
Are they all the same though?
They're not all the same. They're not all exactly the same. They're
not. How did the same words get at the top?
They don't all get the same words at the top. There are six places in the Torah where you have to have the same, the right words.
So
at the
how
top.
Would it work out if they're different?
Yeah, a good sofer, a good scribe has to plan ahead. Yeah, okay. But there is a somewhat standard form today. In the whole idea of standardization is a very new thing, because in times when you don't have Jews from the Mediterranean regularly intermarrying with Jews from Germany, right? You didn't have that typically, you know, for a very long time. So you just had your own community. That's what you know. So a sofer learns how to write a Sefer Torah, he wouldn't necessarily be able to see what another one did somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Today, because of printing. And we have all these different svarim around, so you see what other people have done, and you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain standard that has emerged. So I think today, a typical Sefer Torah, there will be some kind of standard, and I don't know how many lines it is. 60 sounds too much. I just looking at a typical Sefer Torah, I think 60 is a little bit much, but I don't know how much it is. I should really count.
Nowadays, they also take a new Sefer Torah and they put it through a computer check to make sure there's no errors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They do that. They do that with tefillin, they do it with mezuzah, they use a computer check. It won't catch everything, but it'll catch a lot of things.
Yeah, it doesn't catch everything.
It won't catch. There are certain things that have to be. You have to look at carefully, but yeah, that's what they do. Okay, let's continue here. Let's finish a few more psukim before we have to end. Yurches 18. Vayomer Eli, and he said to me, meaning Hashem said to me, Ben Adam, son of man, Kalmar Hashem Elokim, says Hashem God, Eilech Hukosa Mizbeach, these are the laws of the Mizbeach, Biyom Heas, so on the day that it is made, Lehalos Olav Ola, to bring upon it an Ola, a carbon Ola, which is a sacrifice that is completely consumed by the fire, none of it is eaten, Velizok Olav Dam, and to throw upon it blood. V'nasata el ha-kohanim ha-leviim, you shall give to the kohanim, to the kohanim, the leviim, meaning the kohanim from Shevet Levi. Asher heim mizera tzadok, that are from the descendants of tzadok, I'll get back to that in a moment. Ha-krovim elai, that are close to me. Nu'um Hashem Elokim, says Hashem God, l'sharseini, to serve me. Par ben bakar l'chatas, a young bull for a chatas, a carbon chatas, which means a sin offering. So on the day that you initiate the Mizbeach, after it's built, you give to the Kohanim a young bull, which is going to be offered as a chatas, as a sin offering. V'lakachtami damo, and you will take from its blood, meaning the Kohanim will take from its blood. V'nasata al arba karnosav, and you'll put it on its four corners. V'al arba pinoso azara, and on the four corners of the azara. Now the azara, we would have normally taken to mean the sanctuary, but here it doesn't mean the sanctuary, of course, it means the mizbeach itself, which is called azara. V'alagivul saviv, and on the boundary around it. V'chitesa oso, and you shall purify it. V'chi partahu, and you shall atone for it. Which means that by doing this, you will initiate it, you will officially make it into a holy structure. When the mizbeach is first built, it's nice and all, and it looks like a nice mizbeach, but it doesn't have any sanctification. This carbon will then sanctify it from then on. So here we're going to have a series of carbonos, which, let's cover as many of it as we can. This is very similar to the process of initiation of the Mizbeach that took place in the Midbar, which we read about in last week's Parsha, Parshas Tetzaveh. In Parshas Tetzaveh, Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu what you should do on the day of the initiation of the Mishkan. And then later on, that's when he tells them what to do, but they don't actually do it, because it's not built yet. Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh, they're told about it. In Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh, they're told about what they should build and what they should make, and including the clothing, and then what the initiation process will be. In Parshios Vayakel and Pekude, they actually build the Mishkan and make the clothing. And then in Vayikra, in Parshios Tzav and Shmini, that's when the initiation process actually takes place. So here in Tetzaveh, we have the instructions of what to do. In Parshios Tzav and Shmini, they actually do it. So here we have a very similar process, but it's not exactly the same. Rashi does not know why there are differences. Why is the initiation different in the third Beis HaMikdash than in the Mishkan?
Why do we have a young girl, Rabbi? Any reason?
I don't know why. I don't know why.
Tzadok.
What's that?
Who's Tzadok?
Okay, I'm going to get back to Tzadok. I'll get to Tzadok in a minute. Hold on. Chafal 21. V'lakachta es haparachatas. You shall take the bull that is the sin offering, usrafo b'mifkar habayis, you shall burn it at the boundary of the bayis, michutz v'mikdash, outside of the holy area. This first bull was not, its blood was put on the mizbeach, but it was then burned outside the mizbeach. This is a very unusual thing to do. It is only done in the initiation process of the mizbeach. It was done in with the mishkan as well. But it's not a common thing to happen. It's not normally, if it's going to be burned, it's going to be burned on the Mizbeach. But and typically, achatas, a sin offering, is eaten partially by the Kohanim. But this particular sin offering was burned, and it was not burned on the Mizbeach. It was burned outside the Beis HaMikdash after the blood was put on the Mizbeach. Now we're going to have more karbanos mentioned. It's going to be a little difficult next week to lead off with these karbanos, but we're almost out of time, and I want to tell you who Tzadok was. So, Tzadok was the Kohen Gadol when the first Beis HaMikdash was built. When the first Beis HaMikdash was built by Shlomo HaMelech, at that time, Tzadok was the Kohen Gadol. So he's saying from the descendants of Tzadok. This is not the only time Tzadok is going to be mentioned in this context later on. Yechezkel will mention Tzadok again. So, in fact, next week, we're going to lead off with perhaps we'll read these psukim first, but we will, Blin Eder, next week have a discussion about Tzadok and the various branches of Kohanim. We tend to just lump all Kohanim into one group because today we don't know who's from where. So just like we don't know amongst the Yisraelim who's from Yehuda and who's from Binyamin and who's from Naphtali, amongst Kohanim, we also don't know who comes from Tzadok and who comes from other branches of Kohanim, and there is a difference. And we will discuss that, Mirz Hashem, next week, the differences. Amongst the Levium as well, there are differences. There are those who are from Kehas, and those who are from Gershon, and those who are from Merari. There's different branches of Levium as well. So today, we've lost all of the subtleties. So we know who's a Kohen, and who's a Levi, who's a Yisrael. But within Kohen, Levi, and Yisrael, there are subtleties that we've lost. And when Elio and Avi comes in the future, he'll let us know.
When it says son of, it's talking about
descendants,
not just people who are behaving like them.
Right. Here it means descendants of Tzadok, the Kohen Gadol. But the Tzadok is no longer alive at this time. He had lived well over 400 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But this is he's talking about his descendants in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mirat Hashem, next week we'll talk about Tzadok and the other branches of Kohanim when we finish off this parak.